The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Okay, good morning. We'll hear argument this morning in four cases which we've consolidated for purposes of oral argument. The first number of these cases is 20-2230, Red Sun Farms versus United States, and the other three cases go together with that one. We'll begin with Mr. Sykes, and when you're speaking, it would be helpful if you would identify which of the four cases you are counsel for the appellant or appellant in. So go ahead, Mr. Sykes.
Thank you, Judge Dyke. Good morning, and may it please the court. For the record, my name is Devin Sykes. I'm with Aiken Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the five associations who are appellants in Consolidated Appeal Number 20-2232. As you know, I will address question one.
But I think what I'd like you to do is to identify which case you are counsel in. I know you're representing all of the appellants here for this purpose, but which case are you counsel in?
Yes, Your Honor. So I am counsel in the case that begins Confederación de Asociaciones.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, great. So as you know, I will address question one in the court's January 5th order. Question one raises a straightforward issue. Did appellants moot their claims regarding Commerce's unlawful termination of the 2013 agreement when they signed the 2019 agreement? The answer is just as simple, no. The operative test here is whether appellants have a concrete interest in the outcome, however small. The CIT incorrectly concluded that appellants have no such interest, and then took the extreme and improper step of dismissing appellants' actions with prejudice. The CIT got it wrong for at least two reasons. First, the CIT incorrectly held that appellants voluntarily signed the 2019 agreement. That holding, however, erroneously ignores the factual allegations in the appellants' complaints. At this stage of the dispute, the CIT had no choice but to assume that allegations in the complaints are true, even if doubtful in fact, and even if the trial judge did not believe them. Appellants alleged in their complaints that they were forced and compelled to sign the 2019 agreement. The CIT had no license to ignore those allegations. Now, second, apart from its failure to accept appellants' factual allegations as true,
What are the other claims with respect to the 2013 agreement? I know that one of them is duress. The others are that the statutory requirements for termination of the agreement weren't complied with, and there's a dispute as to whether they applied to the 2013 agreement, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The other argument, which is related to that, is that improper political influence actually drove Commerce's unlawful termination, and that they offered as pretext the termination clause in the agreement.
So what case supports the notion that improper political influence is a basis for treating the 2013 agreement as still in force?
As treating it still in force. That is one of the, let me answer your question directly, Your Honor. What we point to in our brief, of course, is the recent DACA case from the Supreme Court that says an agency's decision has to fall within or has to be based on the four corners of the record. We argue here that the improper political influence falls outside of the four corners of the record, and therefore that the termination was unlawful. Does that answer your question?
Go ahead.
Thank you.
This is Judge Toronto. Can I just ask, is your claim about duress that both the 2013 termination, that is the termination of the 2013 agreement, was under duress, and that entry into the 2019 agreement was under duress, or is it one or the other, or what?
Your Honor, our duress claim is more closely related to the signing of the 2019 agreement.
Okay. And do you have any case law that well, first, I guess there's a threshold factual question. Are the signatories here free always to withdraw from the agreement?
Of course they are, Your Honor, and thank you for raising that point. As you know, the CIT did offer that rationale in its opinion below, and actually all the decisions below. But although true, and although it's true that the appellants are not paying cash deposits or dumping duties, that doesn't negate the fact that appellants are already suffering an injury. And nothing in the law requires appellants to suffer yet more injury or experience total injury before their claims are properly ripe for review.
That feels more like it's getting into the next questions to me. I'm trying to figure out. You say that the entry into the 2019 agreement was under duress, and are there cases that say there can be a without further specificity a duress defense to or charge against an agreement that the party is legally free to walk away from?
We did not find any cases during our briefing. Of course, as you know, Judge Toronto, the most applicable cases, at least under this court's jurisprudence, are the Freedom New York case and the North Star Steel case. Those are the two cases that talk about duress, albeit in the context of a procurement contract.
And did one of them involve a situation where the party actually couldn't walk away and not actually carry out any stated obligation of the agreement?
From our review of those opinions, Your Honor, we could not tell whether that was true.
Okay.
All right, just to complete the circle, the remaining argument about the 2013 agreements is that the Commerce's ability to withdraw from the agreements was governed by the statute, and that the statutory conditions for withdrawal weren't satisfied. What's the basis for the argument that statutory provision applies here when the agreement itself gives the right to withdraw to Commerce?
Right. So our argument, Your Honor, is that Commerce cannot augment its authority that is cabined by statute. And I would say to the extent that Commerce itself felt that it had broad authority to terminate agreement whenever it pleased, it didn't codify it in its regulations. That's at 19 CFR 351-209. The other couple points I would make on this, as you know, Judge Dyke, the statute limits when Commerce can enter into the suspension agreements. It's got to be extraordinary circumstances. And the legislative history, which the government cites in its brief, also underscores that these are extraordinary circumstances, and these agreements are meant to be used to conserve resources and achieve quick results. Our argument would be that it would be illogical for Congress to authorize Commerce to, you know, enter into these sorts of negotiations under these circumstances and with those goals in mind, only for Commerce then to willy-nilly terminate them whenever it pleased. I would also say at this stage, Your Honor, just at the outset, as you know, the test is whether we have asserted a plausible claim under Twombly and the related cases. As the Supreme Court said in Chaffin, the inquiry right now is not whether there's a prospect of whatever the prospects of success are not pertinent to the mootness inquiry, which is where we're at right now.
Right, but just in terms of plausibility, in the absence of additional facts, and you can tell me if there are additional facts, why is it plausible to say that there was duress in the circumstances that have been presented to us here, in particular the walk-away right? And that may not be the only thing, but why is this plausible?
Sure, absolutely. So in our complaint, Judge Toronto, we outline how several of the appellant's members went out of business after the 2013 agreement was signed and before the 2019 agreement was executed. So although it comes across as a choice, it's really a Hobbesian choice. The appellants had the opportunity to either go out of business or sign the agreement. And the fact that appellants chose to mitigate their damages, although still suffering injury, does not mean that their claims were moot. And it also demonstrates that, in fact, they were effectively forced to sign the agreement under duress. So so as not to suffer further injury.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, your first response to Judge Toronto's earlier question was that the duress is more related to signing the 2019 agreement than anything dealing with the 2013 agreement. So can we focus on the duress for the 2013 agreement? I guess I'm getting confused between the two agreements and the allegations here.
Sure. So thank you, Judge Prost. So just to clarify, we don't have a duress claim related to the 2013 agreement, the termination of the 2013 agreement. The allegation with respect to the 2013 agreement is that Commerce didn't satisfy the applicable statutory and regulatory requirements. The separate related count is that our appellants signed the agreement under duress.
So aside from the duress theory, what are the objections with respect to the 2019 agreement? What are the bases for setting aside the 2019 agreement other than the alleged duress?
Right. We're not challenging the terms of the agreement per se. What we're saying is that the terms of the agreement have imposed additional onerous and injurious obligations on appellants that they otherwise wouldn't have accepted, but for the unlawful termination of the agreement, the fast-track investigation that required appellants to submit information in condensed timelines, which, by the way, normally take about a year at least, and then as a result of that and a result of the higher dumping margins that were calculated, our clients felt they had no choice but to sign the agreement. I apologize.
I'm not quite following this. You say the 2019 agreement should be set aside because of duress. And then you talk about various problems with the anti-dumping proceeding. And if there were problems with the anti-dumping proceeding, presumably those could be challenged as part of the challenge to the commerce determination. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But aside from the duress claim, is there any other separate argument for setting aside the 2019 agreement?
Again, Your Honor, it would be the Commerce's failure to satisfy the statutory and regulatory conditions that we outline in count one. Excuse me.
But those could be raised as a challenge to the final anti-dumping determination, right?
Under this court's decision in Miller, that is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can I just ask one final question? You haven't yet, I think, at least this morning, disputed the proposition that if the 2019 agreement is a valid agreement, i.e. not voidable for duress or something, then that would actually make relief on any challenge to the termination of the 2013 agreement unavailable, and therefore the challenge to the termination of the 2013 agreement is moot. Do I understand that right? That the entire objection or challenge here, at least, to the mootness ruling as to termination of the 2013 agreement is that the 2019 agreement is itself void for duress and nothing else. So that if we rejected the duress challenge, then on this first question, indeed, there would be no available relief for the termination of the 2013 agreement. I hope that was clear.
I think so. I think I'm understanding. What I would say, Judge Toronto, is that if you disagree with our duress claim and if you disagree with our claim about the statutory and regulatory violations, or excuse me, the statutory criteria not being satisfied, then I agree with you, then that would be foreclosed. Our arguments regarding the termination of the 2013 agreement would be foreclosed.
Okay, now, and the statutory qualifications are qualifications for termination or qualifications for termination of the 2013 or for entry into the 2019?
They're in fact related, Your Honor, because without a proper termination, we don't even get to the signing of the 2019 agreement.
Well, there, as I understand it, there are arguments as to why it was improper to terminate the 2013 agreement because you alleged that the statutory conditions had to be satisfied before that could happen.
That's correct, Judge Dyke.
Okay.
Okay.
Here I'm into my rebuttal. Okay, great. Thank you.
We'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal, okay?
Thank you.
And we'll hear from the government.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. This is Robert Kapura of the Department of Justice Civil Division. And good morning, and may it please the court. The Court of International Trade was correct in its determination.
This Judge Dyke, I find very odd the notion that the signing of the 2019 agreement rendered the challenges to the 2013 agreement moot. It may be that those challenges don't have any merit, but if in fact, for example, they were to succeed on the claim that the 2013 agreement was improperly terminated under the statute, I'm not sure why the signing of the 2019 agreement renders that claim moot.
Well, Your Honor, it goes to the relief that could be provided by the Court of International Trade. Specifically, the relief that had been sought was the appellants sought to prevent commerce from suspending the liquidation of imports, resuming the underlying anti-dumping investigation, and requiring cash bonds or deposits. The 2019 suspension agreement provides all of those things. So there was no further relief that the trade court could have provided after the suspension agreement.
Well, if they reinstated the 2013 agreement, that would be a form of relief. I mean, it may be that the claim on the merits fails, but it doesn't. I don't quite understand why the execution of the 2019 agreement automatically renders the case moot. And there's also the claim that the 2019 agreement was entered into by duress. That may be that the claim has no merit, but it seems to me that it's not a question of mootness. It's a question of lacking a claim on the merits.
Well, Your Honor, the 2019 agreement replaced and superseded the 2013 agreement. So again, there was no action that the trade court could have taken once the agreement was entered into.
I don't understand that. Their theory is the agreement, 2019 agreement, should be set aside for duress, and that the termination of the 2013 agreement should be held to be improper because it didn't comply with the statutory standard. I don't understand why those claims are moot. They may not have merit, but why are they moot?
Well, Your Honor, with regard to their claim of duress, as was mentioned earlier, the parties can withdraw from the 2019 agreement at any time.
That's an argument that the claim has no merit. That's not an argument about mootness. If they were to prevail on the duress claim and the statutory violation claim, relief would be available. It's not moot.
Well, again, Your Honor, the issue with regard to the mootness simply goes to what the trade court could order, what action the trade court could order Commerce to take. The effect of withdrawing from the 2013 agreement was that Commerce, you know, again, took those actions I mentioned earlier. They suspended liquidation and sought the cash deposits and continued with the investigation. So those were the actions that the challenge, that's the effect of the challenge to the withdrawal from the 2013 agreement, would be to prevent Commerce from taking those actions. And what our argument is that because that was the effect of the withdrawal, the signing of the 2019 agreement had that effect. So there was nothing further that
the 2019 agreement and reinstate the 2013 agreement, that's significant relief that's available to them. They may not be entitled to it, But the claims aren't moot, are they?
Well, again, Your Honor, we believe that they are because they voluntarily entered into the 2019 agreement.
This is Judge Toronto. Can I ask, I guess, just to follow through on this? I had understood, I guess it's sort of two parts to what I want to ask you about. I had understood that the principal, let's call it mootness contention, but the contention that no relief is available that could benefit the plaintiffs by a ruling on the illegality of the termination of the 2013 agreement, that the principal point requires us to say whether on the motion to dismiss the 2019 agreement is invalid for duress. Now, I think I hear you saying that somehow even without our deciding that, because if we were to decide there's a viable, plausible, non-Rule 12b claim of duress, do you still have an argument that the challenge to the 2013 agreement is not a live one, that is not one from which the plaintiffs could secure any relief?
Well, Your Honor, if I'm understanding your question correctly, the other problem that we're confronted, or that appellants are confronted with here, is that there is no challenge to the 2019 agreement. In three of the four cases presently before the court, there is no attempt to challenge the terms of the 2019 agreement. And as counsel mentioned earlier, the one case that does contain a challenge doesn't actually challenge the terms of the 2019 agreement itself. It simply alleges that the 2019 agreement was only entered into under duress from withdrawal from the 2013 agreement. So in other words, that's not a direct challenge to the 2019 agreement. So
I'm not sure why it matters whether it's a direct challenge. I thought all the plaintiffs were saying, all of the plaintiffs here are saying, no, that the 2019 agreement can't have any negative effects on our ability to challenge the 2013 termination, which is what the CIT said it did have, because that agreement is void for duress. Don't we have to decide that at least? Or are you saying that somehow, even if the 2019 agreement is for 12B purposes, void for duress, or that the plaintiffs, even if we say that the plaintiffs have a merits claim that they should be allowed to move forward in the litigation with, that still there is no possible relief from the challenge to the termination of the 2013 agreement?
Well, I would agree with Your Honor that the plaintiffs are seeking to void the 2019 agreement based on duress, but again, the issue with that claim, and I understand, you know, this will be addressed later, there's an issue as to whether or not you know, that claim is proper and timely. But beyond that, they're asking the court to void the 2019 agreement when they can withdraw from it at any time.
I guess that feels to me like an argument which you have not yet made, that indeed there is no plausible, for 12B purposes, claim of duress here.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Why is there no plausible claim of...
What's the case law authority that says when the allegation of duress is made, at least on these facts, that doesn't rise, you know, meet the Twombly standard for plausibility?
Well, Your Honor, in terms of the case law, as was discussed in the earlier argument, it's the plaintiff's burden to invoke the court's jurisdiction, and they haven't cited to a single case which would support an allegation of duress in these circumstances. In fact,
that's an argument that they don't have a viable duress claim. It's not a mootness argument. Don't you agree that we have to decide the duress issue, whether there's a reasonable claim here, a viable claim?
Yes, Your Honor, there's a claim regarding duress, but again, as counsel, I hear my time is expended, if I might briefly conclude.
Go ahead.
As counsel indicated earlier, that challenge would go to the 2019 agreement. They're alleging that the 2019 agreement was entered into under duress. But again, the problem with that is the only way that there's really two issues with it. First and foremost, as we've already mentioned, they can withdraw from that agreement at any time. And second of all, the duress that they're alleging was the continued investigation and the suspension of liquidation and so forth, which if they had allowed that to proceed, there was a way for them to challenge that under the statute once the final determination had issued. There was no other duress beyond that. And
decide the duress claim, don't we?
Well, certainly appellants have alleged that, Your Honor. So yes, the claim, the argument should be decided. But again, that goes to their argument on the 2019 agreement and has no impact on the fact that their agreement to the terms of the 2019 agreement removed any possibility of relief related to the 2013 agreement.
Okay. Well, unless my colleagues have any questions, let's hear from Mrs. Alves.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mary Jane Alves from Cathy Levy Kent on behalf of the Florida Tomato Exchange. You were asking this morning about whether there was an opportunity for the respondents, Mexican respondents, to challenge the termination of the 2013 agreement. And in fact, there was. They attempted to prematurely challenge the termination of the 2013 agreement. And as Judge Toronto may recall, this court actually denied a petition that CADIS had filed where they were seeking a writ of mandamus to the Court of International Trade, which had denied their request for an injunction against the withdrawal from the 2013 and the imposition of the suspension of liquidation. At the time, in front of the Court of International Trade, CADIS conceded, and the court in CADIS 3, 459 F sub 3D, recognized at the time that CADIS actually conceded that each of the prior agreements had replaced the preceding agreements, and that's in their brief at page 9. And in addition, they also conceded that they were not challenging the legality of the withdrawal.
This is Judge Toronto. Can I just ask, is the argument that are all of the plaintiffs who are raising a 2013 termination agreement in front right now, that is all the ones who are in front of us now, were they also essentially party to that concession?
Your Honor, yes, because although I'm referring to them simplistically as CADIS, at the time they were representing several associations, and members of GEMD, Red Sun, and Bioparques were part of one of the associations that was represented as part of that litigation.
Okay. Okay.
So are those three parties, Bioparques, Red Sun, and GEMD, are they raising the 2013 agreement point here in their complaints?
To a greater or lesser degree, yes. Each of them has a different finesse on the point, but yes. They're all, you know, challenging the termination and whether or not the termination was legal.
I thought perhaps not Red Sun, but the others, yes. That's, and my notes could be wrong about that. anyway.
Red Sun also has a separate litigation as part of the GEMD litigation. They're part of the same corporate family, as I understand it.
Okay. So what do you make then of I guess our mandamus ruling and or what was said? You were quoting a concession. And can you just go back to say what you think that was or what
yeah,
the words were?
So in the first instance, they brought that appeal too early, and they did seek preliminary injunctive relief to stop Commerce from terminating the 2013 agreement, and also then requiring cash deposits and bonds. And the Federal Circuit and the Court of International Trade denied relief at that time. That's not to say that they could not have appealed the withdrawal from the 2013 agreement, or that there weren't other ways for them to get relief from the courts. The problem is that they made a choice. The time for that appeal would have been to wait until Commerce had issued its final determination and then file a timely appeal at that point in time. However, before Commerce issued its final determination, that's when they negotiated the 2019 agreement. And as CADIS has conceded in its brief, at page 9, each of the times that it has concluded prior agreements in 2002, 2008, 2013, the subsequent agreement each replaced the preceding agreements. You wouldn't want to have multiple agreements in effect at the same time, so the natural effect is when they negotiated and agreed to negotiate the 2019 suspension agreement, that then replaced the 2013 agreement.
Well, that may be, but if the 2019 agreement is set aside on a duress theory that doesn't exist anymore, and then that opens up a challenge to the 2013 agreement, doesn't it?
Your Honor, with respect, I think there. I agree with my colleague this morning, Mr. Capurra, that one, they have not offered a case showing duress in these circumstances. And two, to the extent that they believe that there was duress, they didn't challenge the suspension agreement. This was another opportunity that they had if they believed that...
I don't understand what you're saying. They didn't challenge the suspension agreement? They're challenging the 2019 agreement.
No, Your Honor. There is a specific statutory mechanism for them to appeal the 2019 agreement. They had to file a summons within 30 days after the notice of the suspension agreement was published. And there was no timely appeal of the suspension agreement by any of the parties.
Why does that time limit apply to a duress claim?
Because that's what the statute has set up for any claims that would be subsumed by a claim that there's a defect in the suspension agreement.
Which provision of the statute?
The statute provides for its 19 U.S.C. 1516A, 2B, 4, which provides for challenges to suspension agreements if the party files a summons within 30 days after the notice of the suspension agreement was published.
This is Judge Prost. Just to clarify, was that something that the CIT referenced in her decision?
The CIT did reference in her decision that there was no timely challenge to the suspension agreement. Yes, Your Honor, I believe so.
And citing the statutory provision you're citing now?
I'm looking for that. I apologize. Unfortunately, I don't have a direct site in front of me, but to the best of my recollection.
Your recollection is that that was the basis on which the CIT relied?
Yes, I believe that the CIT would have referenced that.
And your position is that since any challenge to the 2013 to the termination of the 2013 agreement would depend on avoiding an invalidation of the 2019 suspension agreement, and the time limit for challenging that agreement was missed without a challenge, that even a duress argument, which would be a form of challenging the 2019 suspension agreement, is unavailable to the plaintiffs here. Did I understand? That's what I thought I just heard from you.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
But the statute talks about a challenge to the suspension of the investigation. It doesn't talk about a challenge to the agreement, right?
The effect, Your Honor, I see that my time has expired, but if you'll allow me to respond.
When we're asking questions, your time hasn't expired.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yes, the statute refers to the suspension of the investigation, but the suspension of the investigation occurs through the mechanism of the suspension agreement, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, anything further? I hear no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Alves. And Mr. Sykes, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Judge Dyke. A few points, if I may. First of all, the government said a few times that, the signing of the agreement simply wiped away any claims that we might have as to the termination of the 2013 agreement. But nothing in the 2019 agreement itself says that, in fact, the appellants, the folks who signed the agreement, waived any claims as to Commerce's termination of the 2013 agreement. So that's point number one. Point number two, with respect to relief, Judge Dyke, you raised a few questions on this point. As you know, this past summer in July 2021, this court affirmed the CIT decision in CSC Sugar. In that particular case, the CIT had invalidated and set aside an amendment to a separate suspension agreement until Commerce correct the process. And once it did, then the CIT approved that amendment and it was appealed and this court affirmed in a Rule 36. So to your point, Judge Dyke, this court does have the authority to afford relief when appropriate. The other point I will make about is one about collateral consequences. Now, as you know, in our briefs, we talk about this more directly on the claims with respect to the dumping determinations. But we also respectfully submit that the collateral consequences exception to mootness apply here, too, in that the agreement contains numerous provisions that are burdensome on appellants, and Commerce continues to conduct proceedings that administer those burdensome terms, both in sort of the run-of-the-mill quarterly audits and quarterly certifications, but also in these invasive administrative reviews, the preliminary results of which just first issued in October of last year. So we do think even if you were to agree with the government, the signing of the agreement somehow, of the 2019 agreement, somehow mooted our claims as a 2013 agreement, we think that the collateral consequences exception applies with force here, just as it does to the dumping determinations.
I'm sorry, the collateral consequences of what?
The collateral consequences of the agreement itself. The terms
which agreement? Give a date.
I'm sorry. Yes, it's looking for the 2019 agreement, Your Honor.
Okay. And can you address the points that Ms. Alves was making about how at least one, perhaps two, statutory deadlines for making a challenge were missed? The first statutory deadline would be the deadline for challenging the termination of the 2013 agreement, and that was missed because by the time that the whole issue was before that deadline, as I understand it, came round, you all signed the 2019 agreement and therefore thought, oh, we don't actually need to challenge the termination. And then second, the deadline for challenging the entry into the 2019 agreement, let's assume that that equates with the suspension under the statutory before section, that deadline also came and went without a challenge. What's wrong with that, and why, if that's right, is that not sufficient by itself to eliminate any possible challenge to the termination of the 2013?
Sure. So thank you, Judge Toronto. So Ms. Alva's response goes more towards jurisdiction, which Mr. Winton will handle, but I'll say this. As you know, appellants in 2022-32, and I think this is true for all appellants, we filed three separate actions. To the extent that this court, and I'm going to say little I, which is the provision that Ms. Alves referenced, we did file our action within the 31 to 60-day window that allows. That is to a challenge to a final determination. And consistent with this court's decision in Miller, we can challenge the predicate procedural steps as part of that appeal. So,
okay, but that doesn't really answer the question of whether you can have an independent action challenging the 2013 agreement when the contention is that there's a statutory time limit that creates a bar.
And I'm sorry, I believe that the argument was that somehow we have to file within 30 days from the signing of the agreement to challenge that. Is that correct, Your Honor? Is that your understanding? If that was my understanding.
It's 1673 CI. I understand it.
CI, right. So, I mean, the jurisdictional provisions here in terms of the timing to challenge the agreement, you've got to do that within 30 days. That's under 1516A2B4. And I would say that, for example, with respect to the appellants that I represent, we did timely file that challenge in CIT number 19203 within 30 days. So we have timely filed an appeal. I hope that answers your question.
Any further questions?
No.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
And
thank
now
you.
On issue number two, we'll hear from Mr. Durling.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm James Durling. I'm addressing issue number two. Whether the case presents...
Wait. State which group you represent. I know you're speaking on behalf of all the parties in these four cases, but which
sure.
is your client?
My apologies, Your Honor. We represent Red Sun Farms and GEMD.
Okay. Both?
Okay. Yes. And so that's basically matter 2230 and 1292. So my issue is a mix of standing and ripeness arguments, but they really involve a common core set of issues. Plaintiffs have standing because they're already suffering injury in fact, and the dispute is ripe because they're standing and because there's a sufficient risk of immediate hardship. Let me start with two key facts that are really central to understanding this issue. The first is that the 2019 final dumping determination increased the dumping margins, and the second key fact is that determination was never suspended. I want to stress the final determination was never suspended because the government in its briefs repeatedly refers to the final determination was suspended, but that's not technically correct, Your Honors. In fact, the final determination was finalized and issued.
Wait, in terms of justiciability, why isn't this case just like MedImmune?
The case actually is quite similar to MedImmune, Your Honor, in that we agree that there's no requirement, there's no constitutional requirement that you basically take the final steps and compound the injury being suffered. And indeed, we completely agree with the sentiment in MedImmune that when it's the government doing this, when it's the government setting up a sword of Damocles hanging over the parties here, it cannot be the case that to have a justiciable case, we have to let the sword of Damocles fall and inflict even greater harm. There's current harm being suffered. The fact that there are paths that would lead to even greater harm does not in any way extinguish.
Look, it strikes me you're making this much too complicated. MedImmune says that if you have an agreement and you have a theory that the agreement would fall if you're successful, in that case, on establishing patent invalidity, there's a case or controversy. And isn't this the same thing? The statute says the agreement falls if you succeed in the anti-dumping proceeding in establishing no duty or a de minimis duty. Why isn't this the same?
Your Honor, we would agree with that. We agree that the current situation creates a cognizable, there's enough injury in fact to create cognizable dispute now, and per MedImmune, there's no need to wait and take further steps, right? In that case, it was the, you don't have to breach the agreement and compound the injury to have a cognizable claim. So we completely agree with that. So we completely agree with that point, but fundamentally, the reason there is currently injury in fact, obviously MedImmune supports this, but the reason we think MedImmune actually is correct in this particular context, right, is that there is current injury in fact. The final determination still exists. It is a final determination. It has legal consequences. What was suspended was the continuation of the investigation. In the prior panel, you cited this language. The suspension is suspension of the investigation. It's not suspension of the final determination. The final determination is currently having harm. And let me make that very concrete.
This is Judge Toronto. I think I want to take a couple of steps back and then come back to what you're saying. I guess I had thought that a fairly simple view of why you have standing and the matter is ripe and all of that is that if your view of the proper of the challenges to the final determination were to prevail, that the result of prevailing would be a zero or low anti-dumping duty, which would then allow you to withdraw from the suspension agreement and be better off. Why is that not enough, irrespective of some, I don't know, this sort of Damocles idea that you're laying out?
Your Honor, we would agree with that. We agree that is enough. With respect to different parties, the challenges to the final determination might result in different outcomes. There are at least some Mexican exporters for whom that might lead to a de minimis determination, but it is certainly true that for all of the Mexican importers, it would lead to lower dumping duties, because that's really kind of the subtext of what's going on here. This was termination of the 2013 agreement so that the government could take steps to impose significant price increases on Mexican exporters. That on average, the dumping margins increased by about 12%. They were at about 18% as measured by the all others rate, and they increased to about 30%. So this really, you know, stepping back from the legal technicalities, economically, this was about taking an old agreement that imposed one set of dumping margins and replacing it with the new agreement with significantly higher dumping margins that is currently causing injury to the Mexican exporters.
And do the suspension agreements set minimum prices?
Yes, they do, Your Honor. The way it works and the relationship between the final determination and the agreement is you have a determination by Commerce, either a preliminary determination or, if the case is continued, a final determination. Based on that determination, a suspension agreement sets reference prices. The idea is to set prices that are designed to eliminate approximately 85% of the alleged dumping. So there's this connection. The final determination essentially sets margins, which imply prices that have to be charged in the U.S. market. The suspension agreement then goes on to basically say, if you keep prices above a certain level, then you are in compliance with the agreement and we won't take any further actions. That is real and concrete, as you heard in the end of the prior panel.
Just to be clear, do the complaints by the plaintiffs here assert that if the arguments being made to challenge the 2019 final determination succeeded, that they would be better off than if...
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. For individual plaintiffs, the situation might be somewhat different, but certainly they all are alleging that they would be better off if they were not forced to comply with the regime created by the 2019 final determination. The 2019 final determination fundamentally changed the landscape. It forced the Mexican exporters to start charging higher prices. It forced the Mexican exporters to go through these compliance reviews and, you know, going through the procedure and demonstrating that they're charging high enough prices. The fact that there could have been a worse outcome, per MedImmune, that's not required here. There's concrete, real harm being suffered now. Okay? So it's basically concrete harm in terms of the ongoing operation of the agreement. I'm sorry, I think I just heard the buzz for my time. Did I?
That wasn't the buzz.
No, I'm sorry. So it's not just the operation of the final determination and the compliance reviews. It's also kind of concrete current injury in the practical the practical operation of the agreement as well, because it's dictating prices that have to be charged. Private companies suffer harm when the government steps in and requires them to charge higher prices. That's the actual point of the suspension agreement, to force the government to force private parties to charge higher prices, and that's exactly what is happening here. The other reasons there's concrete injury in fact, and the arguments by the government are not persuasive. First, as you'll hear in panel three, that's precisely why Congress authorized a jurisdictional path to bring this kind of case. It would seem odd for Congress to create jurisdiction to allow a fact pattern to be brought into court if that wasn't congressional recognition that in that fact pattern was some cognizable harm. And the fact that the Mexican exporters here can terminate the agreement in no way eliminates the injury in fact. All terminating the agreement would do is basically put them in the situation of MedImmune, which is terminate the agreement and then suffer greater harm from having done so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gerling. We'll hear from Mr. Edelschick.
Thank you, Your Honor. Doug Edelschick, Department of Justice.
So why doesn't MedImmune sink your justiciability argument, assuming that we find that there's a provision of the statute that allows review of the final determination before then there's an issuance of an order?
Sure, Your Honor. MedImmune is very different, and I'd like to drill down on that answer if I could. In MedImmune, the Supreme Court held that a party who pays royalties when faced with an enforcement demand does not vitiate their own standing to challenge the underlying patent. This is because while the party's payment eliminated the potential for violating the law, the party is still paying the money that they claim they shouldn't have to pay. That's concrete, traceable harm.
That's what they're saying here, too, that we're paying money under the 2019 agreement that we shouldn't have to pay.
Well, actually, Your Honor, there's apples and oranges here. That is a question of what they're doing under the 2019 suspension agreement, but what we are talking about is the justiciability of a challenge to the subsequent final determination from the continued investigation. Those are two different things, and as my colleague Mr. Kapura alluded...
But if they succeed on the challenge to the final anti-dumping determination, under the statute, if there's no dumping margin, there's an automatic termination of the agreement. And even if not, they can still then make their choice to terminate the agreement on their own and escape the payments that they have to make under the 2019 agreement, right?
Sure, Your Honor, but the difference with MedImmune is MedImmune explains that when the government is involved, MedImmune says that a party complying with a law can still sue to challenge it. You don't have to violate the law to be able to sue. A threat of government enforcement is enough. But in this case, what's the key difference, Your Honor, is we don't have any...
There's no government enforcement in MedImmune. In fact, the Supreme Court in MedImmune said there wasn't and said this was a private dispute. And
That's right, Your Honor, but the
government cases.
Right. There was a discussion of government cases and private cases. So I'm taking the discussion of the government cases from MedImmune. And we have none of those things that MedImmune was talking about in those government enforcement cases. There's no demand for payment pursuant to the final determination. There's no payment of anti-dumping duties. No one has to comply with the final determination at this time. So it's a Hobbesian choice between complying with the final determination coming into court and suing. They don't have to do either. No one has to comply.
This is just Toronto, but I mean, I guess I keep coming back to the question, why isn't this as simple as they allege highly plausibly that they would be better off if they won their challenge to the final determination because under the governing legal standards, that would enable them to get out from an unduly burdensome current monetary obligation. Why is that insufficient for Article 3?
There's no nexus. There's no connection between those two things. There is no obligation for a current financial obligation. No one is paying cash deposits or duties based on the final determination.
They're paying effectively duties under the 2019 agreement.
Your Honor, if I could, the suspension agreement establishes...
It's setting prices.
Reference prices, that's right. Right. So they're charging more.
That injures them.
Right. And if they wanted to challenge the 2019 suspension agreement through a duress theory or otherwise, as my colleague, Mr. Kapura, indicated, that claim is untimely. And as Ms. Alves elaborated, that claim had to be brought within 30 days of the publication of the suspension agreement, and the only party that even attempted to challenge the 2019 agreement is Cadiz, and they brought their initial suit, 19-203, in the trade court 2 months after the publication of the 2019 suspension agreement. It's untimely. There's no timely challenge to the 2019 suspension agreement before the court. And this, of course, dovetails into the mootness issue as well. If you don't have a timely challenge to the 2019 agreement through duress or anything else, then the 2019 agreement stands unless and until a party decides to terminate. And so regardless of the issues raised related to the 2013 withdrawal, we still have the 2019 agreement. There's no relief that or jurisdiction that the trade court would possess to award any relief relative to 2019. And so what's left of 2013? That's the mootness arguments that Mr. Kapura advanced. Now these plaintiffs are eager for an advisory opinion on the final determination, but their claims of harm are totally hypothetical and speculative. They speculate that if the 2019 agreement is terminated and if the parties fail to achieve a new suspension agreement, then an anti-dumping duty order would issue. And then the final determination would calculate the cash deposits and duties that would be assessed. But that's pure speculation now, especially given that the parties have had a long history going back 25 years of entering into one suspension agreement after another. And as Cadiz admits in their reply brief at page 22, that is, quote, a day that may never come, unquote.
Well, this is Judge Prost. This may allude into our third issue, but what is your response to the argument that if they waited until the anti-dumping order issued, they would be untimely? Then you would be in here saying, making, you know, the cousin of the argument you're making here, that they didn't appeal in time.
No, Your Honor. They've misconstrued the statute, and we'll obviously drill down to that on that issue in issue three. But readily concede that once an anti-dumping duty order issues, if it ever issues, that would be the time, and they would be free to challenge any and all aspects of the final determination at that time in accordance with the statute, as long as they brought their challenge within a timely fashion after the issuance of the dumping order.
Okay, anything further?
Sure, Your Honor. So because at this time there's no concrete harm, no actual or imminent harm, none was identified flowing from the final determination that applies to no one, causes no one any enforcement obligations. There's no threat of enforcing that final determination against anyone at this time. There's no injury, in fact, flowing from the final determination, and the plaintiff's claims are not justiciable. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Alves?
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to make just a couple of quick points. At one point, Mr. Durling had suggested that the final determination is already in effect. But under the statute, 19 U.S.C. 1673 CF 3B, the final determination is not in effect while the suspension agreement is in effect. And so, therefore, I also then concur with Mr. Edelsheck that, in fact, there are no duties that currently apply. And, in fact, that's one of the benefits that the Mexican respondents have right now is they're trying to litigate the dumping margins that they would face if and when there is an anti-dumping duty order while the suspension agreement is in effect so that they don't have to pay duties during that period. In fact, in its brief, the Oparques went even further. They said that the Mexican exporters may or may not decide that it makes sense to remain in the agreement if the dumping margins were set in a lawful manner. So, and that's in their opening brief at page 49. So basically what they're saying is, well, we'd like to see what all of the options are. We don't want to have to pay any duties right now. We like the suspension agreement in that sense. But we'd like to be able to challenge the final determination now so we know what margins we're going to face. And then we'll decide whether or not we want to keep the suspension agreement in place, or we might withdraw at that point because we might.
You're saying like you're sort of conveying the idea as if it were a perfectly self-evident point that's somehow a an improper posture to take. Why in the world is that improper?
It's improper because under the statute sets forth a logical sequence of timing. They actually had an opportunity to challenge the final determination after Commerce issued the final determination if they had not already entered into the suspension agreement. But under the terms of the statute, because the suspension agreement is in effect, the final determination is not in effect, and therefore they have to wait until the order goes into place. On the other hand, their ability to challenge the final determination is not extinguished. They have that ability if and when they choose to terminate the suspension agreement or it otherwise terminates for some other reason.
Well, that's all getting into the statutory argument, which is the next issue. The question is, if the statute provides an avenue for them to challenge the final determination now, in fact, there is a case or controversy. It's not an Article III problem, right?
the problem is right now there is no opportunity for them to challenge that.
But assuming that the statute provides an opportunity, there's no Article III problem, right?
The statute does eventually provide them with an opportunity after an anti-dumping duty.
No, you're not answering my question. Hypothetically, let's assume that the statute provides an avenue for challenging the final determination now. There is no Article III problem, right?
If the statute allowed them to challenge now, correct. There's no Article III problem, but the statute does not.
Okay. Anything further?
I also wanted to respond to your question about the applicability of MedImmune. MedImmune is not at all applicable here because this is a situation where I agree with Mr. Edelschick. The respondents had choices. They had a choice to appeal the final determination and not enter into the suspension agreement, or they had an opportunity to enter into the suspension agreement, which they took. So this is not a situation where they did not have an option to appeal. Moreover, there's an elaborate statutory scheme here that Mr. Durling was ignoring. He kept referring to injury to the Mexican respondents, the notion that they had to either be subject to the suspension agreement or to an anti-dumping duty order. But this is a remedial statute. That is the point of the statute. They were found to be dumping by the Department of Commerce, and in both its preliminary determination and in its final determination, the U.S. International Trade Commission found injury. In those circumstances, the domestic industry isn't...
Thank you, Ms. Alves. Mr. Durling, we'll give you 2 minutes if you have anything further to say.
Just three brief points. First, on the issue of paying money and whether that's a distinction with MedImmune, being forced to pay higher prices is an analogous form of injury. The dumping margins in the final determination and the reference prices in the suspension agreement are really two sides of the same coin, because the reference prices are being set based on the dumping margins that were found, and the dumping margins were impermissible from our perspective. They were unreasonably high. That's the second point. The reference prices, as reflected in the dumping margins were too high. Yes, this is a remedial statute, but the remedy can only be extended as far as there is a reasonable basis for setting those dumping margins. Our core allegation is the 2019 final determination set impermissible dumping margins, and that's what's causing the current injury in fact. And then finally, whether that final dumping determination is still in effect, it absolutely is in effect. It was finalized, right? I direct the court to Bennett v. Speer, where Justice Scalia was commenting on when to think of an agency action as being final, and he basically said, the agency action is final when legal consequences will flow. There are legal consequences flowing from the final determination. The dumping margins in those in that final determination is right now being used in compliance reviews to see whether the Mexican exporters are in compliance or whether they're going to be subject to penalties under the terms of the suspension agreement. Ongoing proceedings, preliminary determination was already made, final determination is imminent at the end of January. This final determination is real, it is concrete, it is having immediate consequences, and for all those reasons, we think there is a sufficient injury in fact to allow for a currently cognizable legal dispute. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That concludes our argument on issue number 2. With respect to issue number 3, we'll hear first from Mr. Winton.
Thank you. This is Jeffrey Winton, counsel to the BioParques Group, which is your case numbers 22, 65, 66, and 67. The issue whether the jurisdictional provisions of the statute require us to wait until an anti-dumping order is published, the statute is absolutely clear on this. Not only are we not required
Nothing about this statute is absolutely clear.
Well, I would say it's complicated, but it's not unclear. And you just need to parse through the provisions. You know, when we sat down to prepare our appeals back in 2019, that's what we did, and we puzzled. You know, which is this? Is this a 2BI, an appeal of a final determination, or is it a 2B4, which is an appeal of a suspension agreement, including any final determinations in the continued investigation? And we said it could be either, and so we filed appeals under both provisions.
But whichever, as I understand it, you're basically relying on three provisions here as giving jurisdiction. One is this IV provision with the including language. Another one is NAFTA provision, and then the general residual provision, correct?
Right. And the argument that we have to wait for the anti-dumping order is based on the premise, first of all, that the...
Wait, before you get to that, tell us... Mm-hmm. Tell us where we have jurisdiction, and then we'll worry about the timing issue.
Sure. So the jurisdiction...
Where the CIT has jurisdiction.
Right. The CIT has jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1581, which says, I think it's C, says that any action described in 1516A, the court has jurisdiction over. And so that handles the first two theories of jurisdiction. And then the third theory is 1581I, residual jurisdiction. The question is this an action described in 1516A? If it is, then the CIT has jurisdiction under 1581C. And if it's not described in that, then it falls under the residual jurisdiction of 1581I. If you then start going through the procedures, you know, the 1516A language, you know, which is this? Is this a final determination in an investigation? And the government says, no, it's something different because it's a continued investigation suspension agreement. That's not a final determination under 1673D or whatever the Tariff Act provision is, 735, whatever. They say that's not a final determination under 1673D, but that's actually flatly wrong because the statute itself says that a determination of continued investigation is a final determination under 1673D.
Now, we're talking about your NAFTA argument.
No, well, yes, this is the NAFTA argument. Under 2BI.
Is the argument that 1516A G3A1 is the provision that gives jurisdiction?
Give me a second. Yes. Yes, in the sense that 1516G would deprive the court of jurisdiction, but G3 says there's no appeal, there's been no NAFTA panel appeal, so then we're thrown back, you know, into 1516A5, which sets the deadline for appealing a determination under NAFTA.
Forget about the deadline. We got to find a provision that gives jurisdiction.
Right.
It has to be 1516G3AI, aside from the including provision, right?
Right. G3I, yes. A determination is reviewable under subsection A if the determination sought to be reviewed is a determination as to which no one has requested FDA review. So yes, that makes this decision reviewable under 1516AA. And then we fall under, on the NAFTA theory, A2BI, which is a final determination. If this were not a NAFTA case, we would have to wait till the anti-dumping order was published to pursue an appeal of a determination under 2BI because that's what the statute says. But it says if it's a NAFTA case, that doesn't apply. There's a different deadline, which is you have to wait 30 days, and then you have 30 days to commence your appeal. That's A5. And so that's our NAFTA theory, and it follows the statute. If we were to wait for the anti-dumping order to be published, we would not be complying with A5. We'd be out of time. And then we run out of, the court, we fail the statute of limitations, which is set forth in, it is complicated, 28 U.S.C. 2636, which says a civil action contesting a reviewable determination in Section 516 is barred unless it commenced within the time specified in that section. So we had to file our appeal within the time specified in 1516A, which, because this is a NAFTA country, to the extent that this is a determination reviewable under NAFTA, we fall under the A5 deadlines, which is the 31 to 60 days. We could not wait for the anti-dumping order. The second theory of jurisdiction is that this is a determination and a continued investigation after suspension agreement, and that's a 2B4. And the deadline for filing a 2B4 appeal is...
Why does this fall under 2B4? That sounds like a provision that's designed to enable someone who's a domestic producer to challenge the decision to suspend the investigation. Isn't that the legislative history of the provision? Am I mistaken?
Well, the language just says what it says, and it says you can challenge the suspension agreement, including any determination.
Well, why would someone be who's subject to the suspension agreement be challenging the suspension agreement?
Well, but we're not. We are challenging the final determination, and as the plain language of 4 says, we can challenge a final determination in a continued investigation. That's what the language says, and if you... read it out as the Court of International Trade has wanted to do. So why would Congress put that in? I could see saying you can challenge a suspension agreement, period, right? That would be one approach, and then I couldn't claim I have jurisdiction. What does this additional language add here? Challenging a suspension agreement, the purpose of this language, there must be some purpose to this language, and it seems to me the only possible purpose is that you get to appeal the final determination if it's a continued investigation. What else could this language mean? The notion that somehow the suspension agreement might include the subsequent final determination is logically impossible because the suspension agreement is always negotiated before you even know if the investigation is going to be continued. So what possible sense could this mean? The only way this language makes sense is if you say Congress intended that you be able to appeal both the suspension agreement and any final determination and continued investigation, and that you should do that on a different schedule than if it were, say, a determination leading to an order. And one reason may be, quite obvious. In a normal case, you have a determination. The order is, 2 months later. You have the commerce determination, 45 days later, the ITC determination, and then like a week later, the order, so there's not that long a period. But with the suspension agreement, there can be a very long period, as we've seen, it may be never, between the determination and the anti-dumping order. And therefore, it makes sense to allow you to bring the challenges to the determination more quickly, which is what Congress has enacted. I'd also say there's an argument here
Mr. Winton, this is Judge Toronto. Can I just double-check something? Am I right in thinking that, I guess it's under 1673CG, both domestics and exporters, if the exporters account for a significant portion of exports, have the statutory right to request continuation even after a suspension agreement is entered into?
Yes, I believe that's right, and that would have given us. Yes, I believe that's right. I would need to double check the statute, which I don't have.
Does that have any implications for an understanding about whether Congress understood or didn't understand or expected that parties to the suspension agreement would be among those who would be requesting continuation because the result of the continuation would matter to them even while the suspension agreement is in effect?
Yes, I think that's right. But Judge Toronto, I think you got my client's position exactly right. You know, we challenged the termination of the agreement. We think the whole thing was unlawful and ultra vires. But beyond that, we think we're entitled to have to look at this and say, what were the real dumping margins here? What were the real dumping margins here? And then to make a decision how to move forward, because we feel that we're harmed. And my client is the one who's really exposed because our dumping margin is 10% higher than anybody else's. But beyond that, you know, we want a properly calculated dumping margin, and then we, you know, we think we're harmed by being forced into suspension agreement. And if the dumping margin were lower, you know, it might be de minimis. We might be out of this case. It might be low enough that we say, you know, having a dumping order is better than having to live with the suspension agreement. And so going back to, it's not my statutory argument, but on the harm issue, we feel that we are harmed, obviously harmed here. I don't know. I heard a beep. I don't know if that means my time is up. It's many different beeps. I would add, if I can, there's a notion that the statute disfavors appeals before there's an anti-dumping order, that in the absence of the anti-dumping order, the statute just doesn't allow appeals. That is also flatly wrong, because if you look at, and it's not directly relevant here, but 1516A3 talks about situations where the ITC finds no injury. Commerce finds dumping, the ITC finds no injury, and the statute explicitly says you can appeal in that situation. So from a statutory point of view, it's clear Congress did not think you always had to wait for an anti-dumping order to be published. And in fact, in the NAFTA context, we cannot wait till the anti-dumping order is published, because then our appeal will be untimely. I don't know, I can keep walking through this, but maybe it'd be better to save my time for rebuttals unless there are questions.
Okay, hearing none, thank you, Mr. Winton. Mr. Edelchick?
Thank you, Your Honor. Doug Edelchick, Department of Justice. I'd like to start out with just a point of agreement. I agree with Mr. Winton that the final determination at issue is a final determination resulting from a continued investigation under B4 of the statute, 1516A. So we're talking about a B4 determination. And why does that matter? Well, it matters because the new NAFTA provisions, the USMCA provisions in subsection G of the statute, don't apply to final determinations from a continued investigation under B4. Under 1516A, subsection G1B, the statute defines determinations that are subject to those NAFTA provisions, which alter the timing and whatnot. And the definition of what, let's call it a NAFTA determination, a determination that's subject to these NAFTA provisions, it includes B1 determinations, B2, B3, B6, and B7 determinations. It does not include B4 determinations. And so that is why none of the NAFTA provisions apply in this case. So we're back under...
But what about 1516AG3A1?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you give me that subsection again, please?
1516AG3A1.
Right. That would not apply because those... that's using the term determination.
Yeah.
And determination is defined as only those B1, 2, 3, 6, and 7 determinations,
yeah,
not a B4 determination.
No. I'm not talking about the including provision. I'm not talking about B4 now. I'm asking you a different question of whether under the NAFTA provisions, which say that if you don't go to the bilateral panel, you can get a determination under subsection A.
Yes, that provision does not apply.
Why not?
That only applies to what I'll call NAFTA determinations, those determinations that are described in G1. And B4 determinations are not NAFTA determinations.
No, you keep going to B4. I'm not talking about B4. Forget about B4. There are two separate theories here. They have a theory that 1516 G3AI, or 1, is an additional avenue to review, which is not dependent on falling within 4.
That is not correct, Your Honor. Well, I understand your question. Their argument is not correct, Your Honor, because the provision you just cited, G3A1, uses the term determination, which is a defined term in subsection G.
Yeah.
This determination, a final determination from a continued investigation, is not a NAFTA determination for purposes of subsection G.
Go ahead, Judge Toronto. You had a question.
Yeah, I thought what I was hearing from Mr. Winton is that if you start with this G3A1, and which does refer to a determination, on that theory, this is a 1516A2B1 case, not a B4 case. And so it doesn't, and B1 is included in the definition of determination under G1.
It would be, but this is not a B1 or a garden variety B1 determination. And
I think he agreed that this was not a garden variety one, but he said it is a NAFTA one.
Right, and it's not, Your Honor.
Is your theory that this is not a final determination under 1673D? Is that your theory?
Not under B1. It's a B4 determination.
Forget about B4. We're not talking about B4.
Well, actually, Your Honor, respectfully, we are. B4 talks about final determinations resulting from a continued investigation. That is exactly.
Please stop talking about B4. We're not talking about B4. There's an alternative route to jurisdiction that they have argued, which has nothing to do with B4. And
right.
We're trying to ask you as to why that alternative theory is not correct.
Right. And it goes back to the structure of the statute. If I could, Your Honor, explain. Under B1 determinations are your garden variety final determinations, final affirmative determinations. And those, the statute teaches, are reviewed in conjunction under 2A I,
why,
Roman.
Why is this not a determination under B1? Final affirmative determinations by the administrative authority under 1673D. Why is that not within that language?
Because those are determinations those types of determinations are those final determinations that are issued in conjunction with an anti-dumping duty order. If we look at this, the structure of overlapping related statutory provisions within A2, we have B1 talks about your final affirmative determinations, and the statute elaborates that under 2A little I Roman 2, those final determinations that are talked about in B1 are reviewed in the context of an anti-dumping or countervailing duty order that's issued in tandem.
Why is it not a determination that falls under B1?
It is not, because this is a more specific type of
language. Read the section. Tell me what language excludes it.
My argument, Your Honor, is based on the structure of a number of provisions. Specifically, I know you didn't want to hear about it, Judge Dyke, but B4 talks about this specific type of final determination, a final determination resulting from a continued investigation. That is different. It's specifically identified as a B4 determination. A B1 determination, in contrast, is a determination that is reviewed in conjunction with an anti-dumping or countervailing duty order under 2A2A1II. So they're different scenarios. One is in the typical garden variety scenario where you have a final determination and an anti-dumping duty order issue at the same time. B4 talks about final determinations in the context of suspension agreements. When there is a final...
Is it fair to say that then you have no argument based on the language of B1 as to why this doesn't fall under B1?
I would not agree with that, Your Honor, because my argument is based on the language of the statute in context of other statutory provisions that are right next to it.
Specifically, to tell me, is there any language in B1 that excludes this determination?
Not in exclusively in B1 standing alone, no. But the canons of statutory construction require us to construe the statute as a whole in context with other related provisions. And right next door to that provision is two provisions. One that says how you obtain review of B1 determinations, and that's done in conjunction with an anti-dumping or countervailing duty order. That's not our situation. There's also, right next on the other side of the house, right next door in B4, specific provisions that pertain to final determinations resulting from a continued investigation, and that's exactly what our situation is. And when you have the statute...
Can I just ask you, this is Judge Toronto, did you have an argument, I don't think you've at least yet made it this morning, that a final determination resulting from a continued investigation is not made under 1673D? Something about the language of either 1673C or 1673D would make... that true, putting aside your argument about an implication of the related parts within 1516A.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm trying, but I'm not sure I followed your
okay.
question.
Okay, so put aside your argument about the structure of 1516A, in which you make an argument about the relation of the various parts under A2A and A2B and inside A2B of little I and little IV. Put that completely to one side and focus just on the language of BI, the one that says final affirmative determinations made under 735 of this Act, which is 1673D. Now, turn to 1673D. Is there language in 1673D or the provision that comes immediately before 1673C that says when there is a continuation of the investigation and that results in a final determination, that particular final determination doesn't come within 1673D? Or do you accept that that does come within 1673D?
I'm not aware of any language in 1673D that would speak to this, but I believe that Commerce's final determination from the continued investigation in this case specifically purports to be a final determination from the administrative authority under 1673C, not D.
What about subsection um, 1673 CF3, which seems to say that it is a determination under 1673D.
You'll have to excuse me one moment, Your Honor, while I have to switch to that provision. So your question seems to F3, Your Honor?
Specifically dealing with continued investigation, 1673 CF3. It seems to say that if there's a continuing investigation of the kind that we have here, that the final determination is one pursuant to 1673D.
That would be if it's a negative determination, it's under D.
No, but the subsection B is dealing with an affirmative determination. It says, again, under such section, referring back to 1673D.
I'll grant you, Your Honor, that the language of these various provisions is not entirely clear, but I would submit to Your Honor that given the structure of 1516A, which distinguishes between you've got the specific and the general, right? You've got the general provision under B1 that talks about final determinations in general, and you've got the specific in B4 that talks about final determinations from a continued investigation. And under the normal canons of statutory construction, the specific should control over the general.
Okay, and anything further? No, go ahead.
Sure. Because the NAFTA provisions don't apply, the 1516A subsection A2 establishes two ways to obtain review. The first way is under AI Roman 2, which allows for review within 30 days after publication of a B1 determination. The second avenue to the courthouse is a review under AI Roman 1, which allows for review within 30 days after publication of a B4 determination. Because we're dealing with a B4 determination, that's the type of determination that is at issue here. And in order to obtain that review, there needs to be a tandem challenge to the suspension agreement itself. The provisions in B4 provide that the review of a suspension agreement may include review of a final determination from a continued investigation. The key word in the statute is including. Congress provided that review of a final determination is included. It's a part of review of a suspension agreement.
Can I just ask you, this is Jeff Turner. Can I ask you, how does the timing work? I mean, I assume that there will be a time gap, and you know better than I what the normal expected range of that time gap is between a suspension, which B4 refers to, and a final determination and a continuation after a suspension. Do multiple B4 actions have to be filed and then they get merged, or how does this work? I thought I recalled that part of Mr. Winton's argument, at least in his brief, was an argument to the effect that the timing rules provided for when you have to sue simply make it unreasonable to view B4 the way you do. So can you explain the timing rules?
Sure. It's quite simple. A party must commence an action within 30 days of publication of the suspension agreement. And if the party also wishes to challenge the final determination from the continued investigation, all they have to do is amend their complaint to include that challenge as well. Or they could file a separate complaint in a timely fashion after and presumably consolidate the two actions. But either way, it's quite a simple matter. And it was Congress that established a nexus between challenges to suspension agreements and challenges to final determinations from continued investigations. But the plaintiffs want to essentially rewrite subsection B4 to delete the word including, to sever the connection between suspension agreements and final determinations, and basically have the statute say or instead of including.
And in your view, you laid out a scenario in which there are essentially two pleadings filed, whether or not the second one is a separate action or an amended pleading. In your view, a challenger, if it did not file a timely CIT lawsuit to challenge the suspension, would have lost its right later, say 90 days later or 120 days later, if the final determination then in the continuation comes out at that point. There is no such right under B4 to challenge that. Is that your view?
They've lost it for now, but not forever. If there is no timely challenge to the suspension agreement, as we have in this case, no one challenged the suspension agreement within 30 days of publication of the suspension agreement. So the statute would provide them with an ability to challenge now within 30 days of the suspension agreement. They didn't avail themselves of that opportunity, but they still could challenge any and all aspects of the final determination if and when an anti-dumping duty order issues. And then they could obtain the normal review of that provision at that time. So it's not as if they're out on their ear. They just have to wait. And they have to wait until a day that, as Katie's has admitted in their reply brief, it's a day that may never come.
You understand this far better than I. So suppose the party, the exporter, enters into the suspension agreement, and say the exporters together amount to a substantial share or significant share or whatever the term
substantially
is.
Substantially all.
And they say to themselves, suspension agreement seems okay, but it's really okay. And they would like to get a final determination, so they invoke the right to a continuation. The proceeding is then underway, and they think to themselves, whether we're unhappy with this suspension agreement will really depend on the result of that proceeding, which is going to get factored into the reference prices and so on. And so we're going to file our action to challenge the suspension agreement and hope it doesn't get adjudicated before the final determination comes out. And so the action is going to be
It would never be adjudicated that quickly. Normally, the final determination would issue in a month or so, which is exactly what happened here.
But your view is Congress contemplated that as something as exporters should be able to do.
Yes, because even though the final determination is not being applied to anyone at this point, there is essentially a boot and suspenders ability of a plaintiff to challenge both the suspension agreement and the final determination at the same time.
Right.
And
I guess I want to ask the question. If Congress contemplated that, where the only substantive aspect of the challenge will be to the final determination and the continuation, why would we read the statute to say that you have to challenge the suspension agreement as a mere formality to hold your place to challenge the only thing you really care about? Congress wanted them to be able to do that.
Well, because I'm quite confident that Congress would not have intended to authorize parties to come into court to challenge a final determination that's not in effect and causes no one to pay anything at this time.
I'm sorry, but I thought you just agreed that B4 does provide for that as long as you've put in a placeholder CIT action on the suspension.
Yes, yes, indeed. So the B4, the entire thrust of B4 is it's all about the suspension agreement. So the first half of subsection B4 talks about a determination to suspend. And then it goes on to say, including a final determination, there's a lot of verbiage here, but if you'll bear with me, including any final determination resulting from a continued investigation which changes the size of the dumping margin or the subsidy calculated or the reasoning underlying such calculations at the time the suspension agreement was concluded.
That's referring to the changing the margin from the preliminary determination?
Yes, exactly. So what this is doing in this statutory provision is it's saying that, you know, normally under APA style review, you would challenge a decision from an administrative agency based on everything that was in front of the agency at the time the decision was made. But this statute creates essentially a little backspin that if, you know, after the suspension agreement is published, there is a final determination which changes the dumping margin or subsidy that was calculated at the time of the suspension agreement, well, you can challenge that too. So it's not just a freestanding challenge to a final determination from a continued investigation. It's all about the changes to what was understood at the time the suspension agreement was issued. And if that final determination, the changes made by it, called into question the underlying rationale for the suspension agreement, well, that would be another reason that the suspension agreement could be attacked. So that's how these provisions all operate together, but it's all about the suspension agreement and the challenge to the suspension agreement. And here we have no timely challenge to the 2019 suspension agreement. So for these reasons, the court should hold that the Tariff Act did not confer jurisdiction upon the trade court to review the final determination because there was no anti-dumping duty order and no timely challenge to the 2019 suspension agreement, and the court should affirm the judgments of the trade court. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Edelcheck. Ms. Alves?
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to make a couple of quick points, but, of course, happy to answer additional questions as well. With respect to the 1516AA2B4 provision, there were some questions about what the purpose of the provision was, and really there are two purposes. One, as you recognize, with respect to the legislative history, it was to give, for example, the domestic industry the opportunity to challenge a suspension agreement or others. It was also designed to provide for a situation where, in between the preliminary determination and the final determination, there were changes that would affect the assumptions underlying the suspension agreement. And Judge Toronto, you had asked about timing, like how quickly all of this happened. The 2019 agreement was published on September 24th. The Department of Commerce issued its final determination on October 25th, and the Commission issued its affirmative final determination on December 12th. So So if in the process, if this case involved a Section B suspension agreement, which it did not, and by a B agreement, I mean under 19 U.S.C. 1673 C.B., if this was a situation where the suspension agreement was one involving an agreement to completely eliminate sales at less than fair value, it would matter if there was a change between the preliminary and final determinations at Commerce, what those
I guess I'm focused a little bit less on the timing at the moment. I guess I want to put to you the question I tried to ask of the government. So as I think you indicated, you agree that under 1673 C.G., Congress contemplated that a variety of parties, the domestics, but also, in fact, the exporters who are parties to a suspension agreement, can ask for a continuation of the proceeding to get a final determination. And B4 specifically sort of zeroes in on the idea that maybe that final determination will actually alter the rates that were baked into the suspension agreement itself, which presumably came from the will have come from the preliminary determination. So Congress is expressly contemplating in B4 that what really may matter to the exporters who have pursued their continuation rights is what happens in that proceeding. Why, if that is congressional contemplation, should it matter that those exporters have to file a placeholder action to the suspension agreement when Congress understands that the only thing they may actually care about is the result of the final determination?
Because only in certain circumstances did Congress actually want them to have an opportunity to appeal under paragraph 4. And that was in a situation where you had a 1673 C.B. agreement, which we don't have here. Here we had a 1673 C.C. agreement, where the agreement was only styled to eliminate injurious effect. So the margins had nothing to do with the suspension agreement. If you had a different agreement, a 1673 C.B. agreement, where the agreement was aiming to eliminate completely the sales at less than fair value, then the change in margins would matter because it would affect the underlying assumptions for the suspension agreement. And so that's why you would want to have that place marker appeal under Section 4, where you would appeal the suspension agreement just in case the final determination that Commerce issued changed that underlying assumption for that Section 1673 C.B. agreement.
But just to be clear, B4 doesn't distinguish among the types of 1673 C agreements that, right?
That's correct. But the implication, the language talks about whether or not it's a final determination resulting from a continued investigation, which changes the size of the dumping margin or net countervailable subsidy calculated, or the reasoning underlying such calculations at the time the suspension agreement was concluded. So the only logical way that this would matter would be in the context of an agreement under 1673 C.B. and not under this. Regardless, though, as Mr. Edelschick pointed out, there was no ability to bring any appeal under this provision because the Mexican respondents failed to appeal the suspension agreement itself, which they do not deny. They needed to file a timely appeal of the suspension agreement within 30 days after publication of the suspension agreement in the Federal Register.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Alves. Mr. Winton?
Thank you. It's Jeff Winton again. I'll try to keep it brief.
So just on this last point about the subsection 4 theory, It's quite odd. It only gives jurisdiction to challenge the final determination if there's been a change in the margin or the reasoning. So this seems to be a very odd way to to create a general challenge to the anti-dumping determination. It seems to be limited to very specialized circumstances. So if here there had been no change in the dumping margin from the preliminary determination, there'd be no jurisdiction under 4 under any theory.
Sure. Well, let me take issue with something my former colleague...
No, but try to answer my question first.
Well, this is by way of answering it. There is here, we have satisfied this requirement. There is a change in the dumping margin and the reasoning. And this is important in this agreement because although it's not an eliminate dumping agreement, it's an eliminate injurious effect agreement, as there are different types of agreements. One of the requirements of that provision is that we have to eliminate 85% of the dumping margin. And so we're in a situation where what eliminate 85% of the dumping margin meant, what we thought we were signing up to, is something different based on what Commerce's final determination says. And so therefore, it's reasonable for us to be able to appeal this. But also say, when you look at the timing provision of the statute, it does not say that we have to appeal within 30 days after publication of the suspension agreement. It says it's 2A1.1 says it's we have to appeal within 30 days of any determination described in B4. And we did that. We filed our appeal within 30 days of one of the determinations described in B4. So we are timely filed. By the way, there is, to go back to something mentioned earlier, there's no...
Excuse me, I'm sorry. This is Doug Adelschick. I think we lost one of the attorneys. I just wanted to bring it to the court's attention. Mr. Kipura dropped off.
I just stopped the clock. I will reconnect. I'll attempt to reconnect them.
This is Mr. Winton. Should I just keep going? Or?
Yeah, please keep going.
Okay. So... Let's go back. Under the eliminate injurious effect type of agreement, we have to agree to eliminate 85% of our dumping margin. So what the final dumping margin is has an impact on the administration of the agreement. It's something that Commerce looks at as part of its compliance reviews in this case. The second point I wanted to make was if this is a B4 determination, as Mr. Adelschick concedes, the timing provision for that does not say you have to appeal within 30 days of the suspension agreement. It says you have to appeal within 30 days of any determination described in paragraph B4, at which we did, because one of the determinations described in paragraph B4 is the continued determination, the continued investigation. So there's no timing problem.
That timing problem wouldn't exist anyway by virtue of 1516 AA5 if talking about the NAFTA, right?
Right. And that leads me to my next point. Mr. Adelschick said, if we wait till an anti-dumping order is published, we can challenge anything we want under 2AI2. And 2AI2 says that you can appeal within 30 days after publication in the Federal Register of an anti-dumping or countervailing duty order based on any determination described in Clause 1 of Paragraph B. So in order for us to challenge things after the anti-dumping orders, Mr. Edelschick suggests, it has to be that this is a B1 case. The determination falls under B1. It may also fall under B4, but it certainly falls under B1, in which case the A5 timing and the NAFTA. So there's nothing in the statute that says B4 excludes jurisdiction under B1 different. And especially where the claim is that really B4 only allows you to challenge a suspension agreement, which is the position of the government, it cannot be then that B4 somehow precludes you from challenging the determination under B1, which because they say it's something different. There's a fundamental inconsistency.
Mr. Winton, this is Judge Toronto. Can I just ask, are there other overlaps within the B reviewable determinations list?
To be honest, I haven't thought that about it, so I'd have to look.
Okay, that's a fine.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Winton. Unless there are further questions from my colleagues, I think that concludes the argument on Issue 3. Now, we had left an opportunity for any party who hadn't been heard so far to present 5 minutes of argument. Is there is there anybody that falls into that category? Not hearing any. I think that concludes our session for today. Unless does any of my colleagues have any further questions?
No, thank you.
No, thanks.
Okay. All right. Thank all counsel. This has been complicated, and you've managed to do it very well, considering the limitations we have because we're doing this remotely. So thank all counsel. The cases are submitted.
The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.